another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One thing that's fun about being older, there are some fun things, is you get to see things develop over time. And being someone who's been interested in psychedelics and part of the psychedelic intelligentsia for many decades now, it's been really wonderful to kind of get a sense of how the generations have evolved, certainly since the counterculture, when really the stuff broke out of very small worlds of researchers and doctors in the 50s and 60s and opened up into this enormous world of countercultural spirituality and renegade science that has been continuing since that point. And of course, nowadays things are changing drastically in the world of psychedelics. It's, you know, every week there's some article in a newspaper about how ketamine can help people suffering massive depression, the rise of ayahuasca tourism, the studies across the country and indeed across the globe looking at psychedelics for everything from treating end-of-life anxiety to PTSD, and the list goes on and on. And it's kind of interesting because my generation, I'm turning 50 next year. I was born in June of the Summer of Love. Is sort of in between these worlds. In a way, we grew up in the shadow of the hippie scene, much more kind of as much punk rock influence as well as 80s video game influence as 60s psychedelia. And we were kind of party to a number of these transitions as they started to begin, the rise of Burning Man, the emergence of research chemical market, ultimately facilitated by the internet. But things are changing even more now. And one of my big questions, and indeed sometimes one of the frustrations about being a bit older, is it's sometimes hard to meet younger folks who are doing things that are really, really inspiring, because they often have their own social networks and old groups, and that's sort of what happens to people. So one of the things I've really enjoyed about the psychedelic scene as a space, as a place of conferences, of conversations, of personal relationships, of texts, is that in comparison with most parts of our society, it's very intergenerational. I remember when I started to go to my first gatherings, and you'd have these enthusiastic young folks talking to, wizened elders of both genders, which has always been an important part of the scene. And so there's a space for kind of people talking through and across different spaces in space and time. And so I was very happy to make the acquaintance of our guest today, Katie Tomlinson. Not too terribly long ago, we camped next to each other at a small festival and had a wonderful time with, long conversations. And it was one of the high points of the festival, actually, was talking to her and her friends and getting to know them and getting to sense a kind of different perspective, like what's actually coming up when people who, let's say, are young people in college, and it's already a world where MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, is already doing its thing, revolutionizing the discourse and the practice of psychedelic therapy and science. So I just invited Katie onto the show so we can talk about her work as a psychedelic activist and how she thinks about these things and what the future holds. So Katie, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, great. I thought it probably makes sense to start out just talking a little bit about your own history with this stuff. And you show up in college. I know you went to Evergreen, mm-hmm. which is already a kind of interesting place, might be nice touching on, and just sort of how you found your way towards an interest in psychedelics, and then from that an interest in really using it as a way to do and think politics.
So I guess I first got interested in psychedelics when I was 17, and I had a friend who was, interested in them. And at that point, you know, I was still in high school and I was very confused by my friends' interest in them because I had, you know, because of prohibition and propaganda, I had believed that that all drugs were addictive, all drugs were bad. But then there was this person that I really respected who was speaking very highly of them, which from that point kind of led to what has been an ongoing love affair with psychedelics. I studied them for about 6 months before ever taking them. And then when the first time I took them, I felt like I had stumbled upon something really special and life-changing. I went to the first MAPS conference, I went to Psychedelic Science, not the MAPS conference, I should stop. It's a conference thrown by multiple psychedelic organizations. And at that point, got more keyed into the psychedelic community, made some connections that are still ongoing today. And then a little bit after that, I had my first, what I describe as my first major religious experience with psychedelics, which is always funny looking back on it and seeing that I still had such a strong interest even without that component. And then from that point, I went to Evergreen, and I started the Greeners Association for Psychedelic Studies. And that was really pivotal. It has been really pivotal in my development as a person and just the things that we were able to do as a group. The organization, we did things like we went to Psychedelic Science with 10 students. We went to the Women's Visionary Congress and we spoke at the Women's Visionary Congress. Our last year there, we threw a psychedelic conference called Generation Psychedelic, and we brought many of what we saw. We were trying to create a platform for the younger voices in the psychedelic movement. So we brought people like Terry Gotham, Brad Burge, so on and so forth. And then just along with that too, we had weekly meetings. We had integration circles with an elder from the psychedelic community. Her name is Law. And then we also had harm reduction workshops. And you know, I felt like we got to do a lot of really good things on campus, and the group is still in existence right now. I just talked to the new coordinator the other day. It's in its fifth year now, which is pretty rare for student groups at Evergreen to continue on that long. So yeah, I'm excited, and I feel like we left a really good footprint on the campus.
Yeah, that's great. Well, we covered a lot of stuff there. I'd love to like go
yeah.
back and unpack some of it. I mean, I first off, I really admire the impulse to study these things before deciding to jump on in. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I find reflected through your experience and many of the younger people that I encounter. That was less true in my era, and I think even less true in the one before, where mm-hmm. there was a sort of sense that there was a value in studying and thinking and learning about the space that mm-hmm. one was going to go into before just plunging in. And you know, and indeed, there's so many different angles to the thing as well that's already sort of a wide open situation. What does it mean to study? What does it mean to kind of mm-hmm. Prepare for it? And so I was curious, like since it was really later that you began to see the full spiritual potential and to the point of thinking about these things as possible facilitators, sometimes as facilitators mm-hmm. of religious experience. When you were younger and you were first kind of getting interested in you're talking with your friends, what was it that intrigued you? What was it that made this seem worthwhile to study and then worthwhile to, you know, take a risk on, you know, at your, you know, relatively young age?
Yeah. I think a lot of it was just trying to understand, like, if these substances weren't as bad as people had told me they were, like, why were they being hidden? So there might have been a little bit of the sense of the taboo there. It might have also just been from, you know, looking at my older sister and seeing her experiment with psychedelics and being fine. And I feel like that it's hard thinking back on it too, because it was so long ago. I feel like it was just, at first it was kind of like a passing curiosity, and then Yeah, you were saying that the older generations, you guys didn't really have the chance for research, but this generation is really lucky because we have things like Arrowood. So it might have honestly just been at first been a passing interest, but then going on to Arrowood and seeing all of that information and learning about all those different experiences, I feel like my interest got more and more piqued. Looking back on it now, it's kind of like seeing that there's a whole another dimension to reality and the life experiences that we can have that I've been told my whole life that was not something that was accessible.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's now that you say that, it just reminds me how if one part of these experiences and these substances is something kind of I don't maybe esoteric is a word where it's sort of a secret. People, maybe you got to figure out how to do it. It's not legal. It's something that happens within a small kind of a community. But by the time once you have the internet, once you have sites like the Arrowood and the Lyceum and the other ones, that there's a sort of just a kind of in a world of objective or reasonably objective information, of group lore, of note taking, of this whole kind of zone that balances out in a way the sort of countercultural esotericism of the things, and makes it really does make for a much more balancing. And I remember when I was in high school, we were nerds, so we were reading things. We read all, there were a lot of hippie books around, but it was a very different thing. It was much more like an introduction into into like a hidden world or a sort of other sort of society. It wasn't like as data driven. And I think that even just the fact that the environment itself is more full of data and more full of kind of rational approaches to these, in many ways, post-rational or non-rational experiences, that alone, I would like to think, is just creates a healthier set of expectations and certainly a healthier set of habits that is appropriate to the sometimes, difficulty of these things. But did you think about them initially in terms of religion and spirituality? Were you interested in religion and spirituality when you were younger, or was that actually almost something that you kind of came to through your apprenticeship with these experiences?
It was something more that I came to. It's kind of hard to describe. Like, I think my first real spiritual awakening I had, and the spiritual awakenings I've had subsequently from this point have got deeper and deeper and continue to get deeper, was actually reading Life of Pi. I don't know if you're familiar with that book or the movie.
I know it a bit, but why don't you sum it up?
So in Life of Pi, there is a character who initially is raised to be Hindu. His father is an atheist, though, but he has a strong attachment to his Hindu beliefs. And then afterwards, he also discovers Christianity, and then he discovers Islam. And he ends up following all three of these religions at once. Which, his mother is supportive, but his dad, being an atheist, is like incredibly confused. But the initial part of these books is just an exploration of, this character's way of finding and connecting to God through all of these different means. And I think that was the book that kind of turned me into a perennialist, and seeing that, oh, okay, there are all of these different religions in the world. These religions have all come to be at certain points without influence of the other. Obviously now they're influencing, but in different points of history. So that means that there must be this core place that religion is coming to. And I felt really awesome when I discovered that. I don't think it wasn't necessarily like a personal experience of the divinity, but it was just kind of a knowledge that it was there. But kind of after that realization, it definitely went more into the background, and it was not something that I was focused on. Which, thinking about what I know about spirituality now, that kind of makes sense. I didn't really have any sort of practice or any way to reconnect back to that feeling. And I remember even saying when I was younger too that like I didn't want to rely on substances to give me a connection to spirituality. So it was, I definitely feel like I had a more, I guess, hedonistic period with psychedelics where I wasn't as connected or thinking about that. But then I went to a psytrance event called Goa Gil, and I kind of got opened up and realized what was, you know, what the actual potential of psychedelics were. And I left kind of with the sense of feeling like, oh, even though I said I didn't want to find my spirituality through psychedelics, I realized that this was kind of the thing that I was really looking for this whole time. And that was kind of like, I don't know. I think there is potential for abuse of psychedelics. And I think I kind of fell more into that a little bit when I was younger. And I feel like when I had that religious experience, it was like, oh, this is the hole that I was trying to fill.
Well, that's very interesting. It's like you almost kind of like you weren't being motivated as a seeker. I think that's mm-hmm. true often in people's experiences where they're interesting, they're fun, mm-hmm. they add a lot of wonder and surprise and weirdness to what can be a kind of fairly boring modern life where all the old enchantments have been chased away. And so we kind of get into it on that level, and then sometimes the experiences that happen within that framework are just so powerful, or they're so resonant, or they mm-hmm. draw together these different threads of our lives and our minds that can bring us into a more religious or spiritual frame of mind. And since some folks aren't going to know about Goa Gill and what his mm-hmm. parties are like, or indeed even what's sort of particular about psytrance mm-hmm. as a kind of music, electronic dance music, but one that is specifically kind of that's keyed to both psychedelics and religious experience in a certain mm-hmm. way. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that revolutionary festival.
Yeah. So I went to Goa Gill many times before I had this experience. And honestly, at first I was pretty put off by the music. Goa Gill plays psytrance, but his psytrance usually ranges between 150 to 180 BPMs. And it's described as being dark psytrance or dark psy. And it definitely, like, when you first hear it, you're like, this music is really menacing and kind of off-putting, and I don't get it. But I kept going to the events because I was really interested in, when I was younger, I was really involved in the Portland psytrance community, and I was really liked the community that was around it, and I liked being around these people that were really passionate about their use of psychedelics. So I kind of kept going to the event, that event for the community, but there was also just this sense of like, I don't get this music. This music is awful. Why? But then when I eventually had an ex-partner who kind of made me realize that there was another realm to the psychedelic experience. And at that point I went to the festival with him, and I kind of realized like, okay, like, he's going for a really different experience. So I just kind of put in my head that like, okay, there is this another realm of experience. Like, why not like open myself up to that? And I found that at first I kind of feel like I got like beaten down and pummeled by the music and had a very intense death experience. But then at that point, after the death experience had ended, the way that I describe it is I feel like I died and went to heaven. And at that point, the music that just previously minutes ago had sounded awful and horrible, all of a sudden it sounded like the most angelic music I'd ever heard. And looking at psytrance now, the way that I kind of interpret it is that in dark psy, there are so many different frequencies present. Like, you have the strong driving bass, which has the more kind of that dark, sinister side to it. But then you also have these higher notes that are happening. And when you're in that psychedelic state, I feel like whatever experience you're having, if you're open to it, you'll latch on to whatever notes are happening that relate most to your experience. But it also, I know, I think there's just something really special about it too, because it has all of those frequencies present at the same time. Like, it really feels like, the way I describe it is like almost like a universal language, or I know, it's for me that music is really sacred.
Yeah, and it's interesting just thinking about Goa Gill, who he was, and the role he played in kind of developing electronic dance music as a vehicle for, you know, psychedelic all night, you know, mystical, mystical and hedonistic celebration, you know, in India, you know, he went over to Goa and in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, like so many people, and had stayed there off and on through to today. And that was the place where the kind of more spiritual dimension of what would eventually become rave culture was developed in the 80s, as people started using electronic music not just to have fun, but to kind of create a night long celebratory soundtrack for, you know, intense voyaging. And I think that music, you know, then kind of evolves into psytrance, and now it's, you know, all over the world. It's one of the, you know, the strongest, I guess, one of the more global EDM musics, and it's anywhere you go, it's kind of recognizably associated with these situations of you know, psychedelic transformation. Thinking back on that experience, though, how much do you think it was because you sort of decided to open up to that possibility almost beforehand that allowed that dimension to unveil itself, versus it just sort of happened? And this is something, I mean, it's a real key question with psychedelics. How much of it is our expectation or our willingness to see how this might work if we adopt a different framework that maybe isn't even our natural way of doing it, that really allows something new to happen, versus things just happening that you're not really in control of, and then they force a change.
I mean, I think go ahead.
No. I was just going to ask what you thought.
I feel like, I know with me, with my history of psychedelics, like one of the things that I kind of like picked up that was a negative trait in the psytrance community was that there were people around me who were doing lots and lots of acid to the point where they were going about many of their normal routines and were able to keep themselves very controlled while they were under their experience. And that, you know, me being like 18 years old and being around these people that I looked up to and seeing that, I kind of started to adapt that as well. I wasn't going to work or anything like that, but there was definitely this sense of me wanting to control the experience and being able to, I guess, quote unquote, like handle my shit while I was high, which ended up being really detrimental in the long run. It kind of made me much less sensitive to the substances. It made it much harder for me. I think that's why I went like, you know, 3 or 4 years of using psychedelics pretty frequently before I had my religious experience. So I think that is kind of, for me, like what blocked me and made me realize that trying to control the experience, like you can do that, but it's going to block you from being able to eventually let go. I feel like there's also many people I've met, though, where they take psychedelics and the first time, you know, they have that experience. And what I find with those people is they tend to be, they're very open. They're very receptive already. And they're able to kind of just like letting go and going with the flow is kind of already their natural inclination,
but that's not the way you were.
No, that is not the way I was. I have become more like that. Meditation has helped a lot. I used to do five rhythms and open floor. It was just a form of dancing meditation. And I started doing that much more frequently after my religious experience that I had, and that made it much more easy for me to surrender and let go when I was in the psychedelic state, because I figured out how to do that when I was sober afterwards. And I also have, I take psychedelics far less than I did when I was younger, and that's also like lowered my sensitivity. That's actually probably one of the big things I've gotten from my psychedelic use, is just becoming a more like receptive person who's like willing to kind of surrender in the right moments.
Well, one interesting question for me is why you choose to describe your experience, which, while it, you know, obviously had spiritual or religious imagery, a sense of heaven, a sense of dark night of the soul, of death, of rebirth, you know, these kind of, you know, topography of experience that we can talk about forever in terms of Jung and religious death and rebirth and all these things. But it's still a very interesting decision, especially if you were coming from a more hedonistic kind of secular perspective, to mm-hmm. use the phrase religious experience, to claim religious experience as a legitimate term for what you're talking about, as opposed mm-hmm. to, well, I had a really trippy thing happen and this and that, and it made me a little more open or whatever. But there's something that's very significant to my mind about you know, standing for that mm-hmm. term and the way and just asserting, confirming that these mm-hmm. substances are part of religious experience, or that they're deeply related. What mm-hmm. where does that come from for you? How did that work?
Yeah, I think that at first I definitely didn't realize it as a religious experience at first. I definitely saw it as a spiritual experience. But then I think my education at Evergreen was pretty awesome in that it allowed me to explore things pretty freely and openly. And there was a book, I'm holding it right now, called Psychoactive Sacramentals, which is all about going into how psychedelics are for spiritual growth. And one of the things I found in it was, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Panky, is that how you?
Panky, yeah.
Panky, yeah. Panky's Good Friday experiment, where he, so Panky went around and he talked to mystics and people who had really deep religious experiences, and he was trying to understand like the nine core, like the core traits of them, and he identified nine different core traits. And then at that point, he met Timothy Leary, and he was really shocked because it was like, well, why is Timothy Leary talking like the Buddhist mystics I've met? And at that point too, like they kind of determined, through the Good Friday experiment that they could bring about the same experience that the other mystics were having, but they were doing it with psychedelics, which obviously there's good and bad for bringing it about with psychedelics or bringing it about with, more traditional means. But yeah, I remember when I just read those nine core traits, like feeling super shocked because I was like, oh, this is like what happened to me. Like this is putting it in terms. And from that point, a big part of my education at Evergreen was studying mystical experiences from that point and trying to understand them. I have a lot of my credits are in consciousness and spirituality. And I feel like that kind of reading that chapter in that book is what motivated that further.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's more, I think, you know, evidence for the way in which whatever else they are, psychedelics create or open up the possibility for you to build your own relationship with them, so that mm-hmm. how you think about them, how you talk about them, how you know, the things you read, the things you research, all these seemingly secondary activities, you know, so different than the experience of actually mm-hmm. being in this altered state, actually really in a way are integral to making meaning, you know, not just mm-hmm. making meaning of these experiences, but just how we make meaning in general. It's like you get to see the way in which we make meaning out of our experience, and that those meanings then in turn, you know, influence subsequent experiences. And so you get this evolving kind of learning process where you're both learning about something mm-hmm. that's non-human, that's out of our control, that has its own sort of weird agenda, depending mm-hmm. on how you want to think about it, whether it's just neurological metabolism, or whether there are, you know, agents and agencies in other realms, to take a much farther out example. But regardless mm-hmm. of that, there's still this way in which we're kind of co-creating the process, and particularly as modern people who might come across these things as part of just, you know, partying or just exploring as a kid or whenever, and then really going, hey, we can actually kind of build these things in different ways, and mm-hmm. That's a lot of what we see there. That's why there's such a wide range of people's reactions to them. Some people still take them very much in a kind of secular frame of enjoyment and exploration, and other people take them, you know, in a profoundly religious framework where the medicine is holy. It brings them into a sacred environment. They can map the worlds mm-hmm. they encounter according to some kind of cosmology. And then a lot of us, I think probably both you and I, are somewhere in between these, you know, mm-hmm. these kind of modes, and being able to study the kind of stuff you did in schools, you know, of course makes a huge difference on how you're able to talk about these things, but also how they actually, you know, appear to you as well.
Mm-hmm. I think a big reason too why I speak the way I do is also just that it comes from having run the student group, and also just from my own experience of, like, you know, I've been studying psychedelics for a really long time, and no one had ever kind of directly said to me, like, hey, psychedelics can lead to mystical experience. And I feel like it's one of those things that people are kind of shy to talk about, or their humbleness kind of stops them from talking about it, because no one wants to come out and say, like, oh, well, I've had this great, like, amazing, life-changing mystical experience. Because then at that point, like, you know, there's that fear of, like, your sanity coming into question, or just, like, do you have delusions of grandeur? But I feel like it is important, especially when in the role I was in, I felt like it was important for me to talk about, because I saw students having these experiences, and I wanted them to know what had happened to them, and I wanted them to be able to get the resources. And I also just wanted people to know that, like, hey, like, this is an option for, if you keep using psychedelics, this is something that could happen.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it was partly out of seeing how that possibility, that idea worked as part of this group that you were doing. Maybe talk a little bit more about, you know, how you set that up. I mean, it sounds like one of the things you were doing were these sort of integration circles, which are so important. And it really mm-hmm. seems like there's more of that activity now than there was. And I'm just kind of curious how you decided to start doing holding those circles, or how you even, you know, once you decided, hey, let's have a psychedelic group on campus, mm-hmm. how you thought, well, what does that mean? What should we do? I mean, there's a lot of different things we can do. Why did you make the decisions you did in terms of how you decided to work with that format?
It felt like the right thing to do. It felt like, you know, I saw all these other student groups on campus, and I, you know, Evergreen is, for people that don't know Evergreen, it's a very liberal college in Olympia, Washington. There are psychedelic mushrooms growing on campus. It has a very, like, strong psychedelic history. And it was one of those things, like, I feel like psychedelics were already such a strong undercurrent at Evergreen, but they were kind of in the shadows. So for me, I just kind of felt like we were at a point, you know, with where psychedelics are, that we could start talking about them more openly. And mostly I just wanted to. I thought it would be fun.
And then how did you structure the circles? Like, did you have sort of an invitation? Like, here we're going to have a night where everybody can talk about their experiences, and would you invite feedback? Would you mm-hmm. just sort of let people describe their own? How did everybody's individual experience feed into the, you know, process that the group was going through in terms of coming up with new ways to think about and to mm-hmm. Discuss these matters?
I mostly let in the situations of the integration circles, I kind of played a more passive role aside from setting them up. As I mentioned before, La Lorien, she was the woman who we brought in to hold the integration circles and to hold space for that. And La is an elder within the psychedelic community and someone I have a lot of respect for. And I met La about a year after starting the student group. So it was in our second year that we started bringing her in and having her facilitate. And for me, it was really important to have Law, because Law is an elder, and one of the things that I want to see more in the psychedelic community, kind of like what you were talking about, is more relationship between the younger generations and older generations, which even outside of the psychedelic community is something I feel is we're lacking on. And Law also, at the end of the day, has been in the psychedelic community much longer than me and has much more experience, so I felt like she was much more qualified.
So would she, you know, offer feedback for, I mean, and I ask this probably because mm-hmm. I've just started to participate in some integration circles in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting world because, you know, on some level, you're just there to provide space for people to talk through on their own. And you maybe mm-hmm. even come up with some, if they have a problem or if there's a concern, to maybe even discover it on their own. But then there are other times when you can see people, you know, being someone who's, you know, this isn't my first rodeo, going like, oh, that's, you know, that's heading towards delusion, or that's heading mm-hmm. towards you know, megalomania, and you know, that, ooh, that's, you know, where you see things that are like kind of recognizable dangers, and then you're like, well, what am I doing?
Yeah.
This isn't like, you know, they're not paying me for therapy, and like how you kind of offer gently feedback mm-hmm. to try to you know, avoid some of the problems that are there. I mean, some of the real issues that do come up with people that are they're not always aware of, and can be damaging. So it's an interesting it's an interesting thing to try to navigate.
We got, in the time that I was at Evergreen, I think we got really lucky. No one really came to the group expressing problems like that. But that was definitely one of the concerns that the faculty had, was that, you know, we're not allowed to offer at Evergreen, you're not allowed to do like therapy circles through your group. So we kind of had to assure them like, no, we're not doing therapy. Like, we're, you know, we're giving support and talking, but it's not, you know, we're not doing anything like that. It was more, I feel like it was a space for people to be witnessed. A lot of times, if it was a more sensitive topic, individuals would reach out to law and ask to talk to her separately. But for the most part, I mean, it was mostly just a space to kind of come together and to talk about our experiences, and to see that, like, we weren't alone in our experiences, and also to see that someone had really been there before.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That sense of continuity. I mean, that is part of the thing that the community need, you know, that's probably why it's there. And what it needs to keep doing is to, you know, create a place where you get a sense of continuity. You know, like even just the willingness to use a term like elder to describe, you know, somebody from another generation is already like a kind of gesture towards a possible way of being that is not the natural way we have in the modern world, where we're just mm-hmm. like, oh, they're old people, or they're from a different generation. They don't have anything to say to me. Who cares? Especially now, because young people live more and more horizontal social lives, because the robustness of social connections within a generation are so even greater now than it was in the 60s, yeah. when there was already this kind of generation gap. And it's been, I think that's actually both one of the sweetest and also in some ways one of the greater failings of the psychedelic movement, is that even though they should have known better, they the first generation didn't do a very good job of figuring out organic, supportive ways to hand over information. There are some serious major exceptions, and you know, the whole world of psychedelic conferences in some sense is a way of trying to, you know, create a way of offering these conversations between, but the kind of intimacy that you're talking about with an integration circle, but also the recognition that there is someone like an elder, there is a role like an elder. I mean, I remember the first time somebody called me an elder, and I don't even know if I was in my 40s yet. And I kind of gulped, but I was like, well, whatever, man. I mean, I'm playing a role in their world. I'm glad to be here, because they were mostly, you know, 15, 20 years younger than me that I was, people I was hanging out with. So I'm like, okay, I'll take it. But it also is a sign of a certain maturity about recognizing the value of that, that kind of conversation, and the value in the other way as well, because it's, you know, the circumstances that one has, especially when you start using these, exploring these things, that really influences in a way your whole approach to them. And sometimes it's much harder to understand what's happening with you know, younger generations. So for me, like, I can't imagine growing up with when Arrowhead's there, or when research chemicals are available online. And I mean, it's just mind blowing. Like, I don't even know how to wrap my head around it. And so, you know, it's also really important to keep the conversation going both ways. And to that end, I would love to hear you riff a little bit about the importance of, you know, listening to younger psychedelic voices now, and particular, like, what issues are different? What things are rising for them or for you that is, represents a kind of change in some of the issues that people are talking about, and some of the opportunities that you see for, you know, expanding and growing this community and this conversation outside of its existing you know, world.
I think what the younger generations right now, or at least what I have been seeing them doing, is there's a lot of energy to legitimize our experiences and the value of psychedelics. And I feel like, you know, with all of the pioneering research that is going on right now with psychedelics for therapy, we finally have this thing to point at and be like, no, look, the data supports us. So we can't be blown off as easily. And I think that that kind of helps give us the freedom to talk more openly about it, to kind of come out more with our experiences. And I see a lot of hope and I see a lot of potential, and I am really excited about these generations of psychedelic workers, because we're going to be the first ones to get to work with psychedelics in a legal framework. And we're going to be able, the first ones to be able to say that, like, you know, be able to say they work with psychedelics without shame or worry. Eventually, you know, come when MAPS or other organizations finally are able to legalize it, I think that will help.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like you can already, you can, even though the problems of illegality remain, and, you know, mm-hmm. you know, people still do time, and, you know, it's, we're still in that drug war framework, in terms of your ability to just kind of stand up and go, I'm not a freak, I'm not crazy, mm-hmm. I'm not dangerous, mm-hmm. and look, here I have all of these organizations and research projects and scientists and, therapists, and look at all of this data. It gives you a kind of confidence to be able to be just, you know, counted in a way that we never had, because it was like you had to be a kind of a countercultural person. Like, not everybody was counterculture, but most people were, you know. And even mm-hmm. if, like, you know, if you just thought about, like, the Grateful Dead, like, you know, a lot of the people who were going to shows by the 80s and 90s were, you know, they were lawyers, they were doctors, they were, like, quote unquote normal people, but mm-hmm. but there was still a sense that the psychedelic world was like this weekend world, or this other world, this sort of underground world where you kind of, like, moved in between. And I think that sense of an underground is one of the things that's disappearing. So even though, you know, dark psytrance and all night dancing to whatever is going to seem pretty weird to people if they're listening to, you know, whatever, country music and stuff, they're going to, it still seems pretty peculiar. Your own ability to kind of go, no, look, these are all tools mm-hmm. and techniques and situations where we can explore things that are clearly developing this real, really solid presence, at least for open-minded people in the mainstream. And that must make a huge difference. But another part of it, it seems to me, is that young people today, particularly, you know, people who are in college, directly coming out of college, there's a kind of renewed sense of political agency and political urgency. I mean, Black Lives Matter is the most kind of obvious example, but there's any number of things that are sort of surrounding these issues of race and gender and sexuality, and how to think about them, how to think around them. And, you know, psychedelics historically in the United States has been extremely white. And pretty hetero. I mean, there have mm-hmm. been those, you know, there's major exceptions. We got to, you know, tip the hat right away to, like, Black psychedelia, Latin American psychedelia, gay psychedelia. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been there. It's, I don't want to crush that, but the dominant tone, the dominant scenes, Deadhead being a perfect example, have been, pretty white and pretty mm-hmm. straight.
Yeah.
How's that changing now? How do you see that kind of shift happening?
Yeah, I would also say that, you know, kind of, I remember Annie Oak telling a story at one point about how she went to the major psychedelic conference in Basel, Switzerland, and seeing that there were only two female speakers during the whole conference, and her just kind of getting this sense of being like, well, this isn't my psychedelic community. And then from that, you know, creating the Women's Visionary Congress. I think that is one example right there of, like, we're seeing more thoughts about creating platforms for women so that it's not just the male voices being present. I think for the current psychedelic culture, though, like, something that is to keep in mind is that, you know, it is still a culture that is embedded in our patriarchal capitalistic society. So unfortunately, it's going to show those marks by being super straight, super white, a little more male focused. But I think what we're seeing, though, is that that doesn't make sense with our values as people who are psychedelic explorers, because, you know, when I had that religious experience, there was this sense of like unity and oneness. And then if that's the case, that means that I'm one with every single human. So any oppression that human is facing is really my oppression, and it's affecting me as well. So I think we're starting to see with more young people, them being aware of that and trying to dismantle their own oppression and trying to create the world that within the psychedelic culture, create the world that they want to see, and hope that that can help spread out to the rest of the culture. I hope that we're making strides in making, you know, the space a less, you know, a space that's more inclusive to people of color. But I still think we have a lot of work on that. I still think we have a lot of work to do when it comes to how women are treated in the spaces. I'm pretty sick of hearing like how many stories I hear about young women taking advantage of, you know, older men who are take on this like guide or guru like kind of position. Like, I still feel like that's a really common problem in the psychedelic world. But I think we're becoming aware of it. And I think that we are striving more and more of living by our experience and trying to be a more inclusive space.
Yeah. I mean, one would hope, I mean, along with just feeling the, you know, the sense of connection with human and also non-human persons, mm-hmm. but is just the way in which if psychedelics can be also understood, not just as a possible route towards religious experience and these kinds of really transformative glimpses of a different way of being in the world, but also as almost critical molecules in the sense that they allow mm-hmm. you to deconstruct actively your own cultural programming, to think about in mm-hmm. those terms. And, you know, that's how people were talking about them way back in the day. But it was always interesting is that certain cultural programs were seen as being available for deconstruction, like participation in capitalism. And people were, mm-hmm. you know, there was a revolutionary interpretation of psychedelics from the 60s on. And, you know, the Weatherman loves LSD because it broke down all of your inherited capitalist mores about property and possession. And so people mm-hmm. really recognized that they could be, you know, that they could help break down certain kinds of patterns. Other patterns tended not to be on the shelf as much. You know, male predatory sexuality, for example, seems to still be a very powerful, you know, attractor, and both for you know, cross-cultural situations with women going down to the shamans in Peru or whatever, or the pseudo-shamans or neo-shamans or whatever you want to call them. It's the whole mix. And those kind of situations, we know we've heard tons of stories about that. But also just mm-hmm. within the psychedelic community, within the world, there have been definitely major figures who are kind of known for their predatory behavior, and watching that happen and sort of sensing both the opportunity to use wisdom to sort of dissolve some of those patterns, and at the same time how difficult it is, mm-hmm. it's a sobering issue, because it does seem to be really still rather pervasive. And I don't know whether that's partly, you know, is that related to the fact that if you look at a lot of contemporary visionary art, some, you know, a lot of which is very generic at this point, though mm-hmm. I still like some of it. But if you look at it, you get what, you know, there's all these, you know, faces of the beautiful young woman and the beautiful young trans, you know, it's all that this mm-hmm. sort of the attraction towards beauty and the beauty around women's bodies is still so much part of this imagery, in a way that, like, it was something that's more punk rock or avant-garde. You would never kind of show women in that way, because it's just too cheesy. It's just like too mm-hmm. like whatever, man. So there's sort of a way in which a certain kind of, there's sort of like a organic hippie-ish way of like celebrating the beauty of the female body that also has a kind of tendency to like maybe feed into ways of supporting more traditional, you know, old school ways of relating between the genders that is no longer helpful. I mean, I don't know. I'm just kind of riffing on it. I'd love to hear what you think.
No, that's actually something I talked about sexism within spiritual communities a lot with the talk I did at Evergreen during my conference. And that was just during the conference in general. One of the things I was impressed with was that issues related to social justice were brought up a lot. But no, with visionary art, I feel like visionary art, my biggest critique of it is I'm like, it's so heteronormative. It's very white. It's very, and it's, I don't know, like I have seen so few examples of like portrayals of queer people, for instance, in visionary art. I don't see portrayals of trans people. I see very few images of black individuals in visionary art. And if I do, they tend to be kind of exotified. And this is kind of what I was saying before, that our psychedelic culture is still coming out of our dominant culture, and that kind of stuff is in our shadow. And a lot of people don't really want to look at it because they benefit from it. And that's the thing, too, with what the problem we see with still predatory men is that there's this kind of ingrained belief that we inherit from our culture. And it's not our fault that we inherit it from our culture, but just kind of this idea that like men are entitled to women and women are meant to kind of be submissive in that way. And one of the ways that I brought this up is that, you know, during my talk a year and a half ago at Evergreen, I asked people to describe the sacred feminine and sacred masculine. And, you know, with the sacred masculine, people were like powerful, driving, like ambitious. And then the sacred feminine, like, oh, she listens, she holds space, she is a nurturer. And I think that the archetype of feminine and masculine are something that can be helpful. I don't think we should dismiss them entirely, but at the same time too, I also see all of those traits more as human traits and not gendered traits. And that we shouldn't necessarily assume, or I hope we eventually can come to a future where we're not immediately going to assume that one person is more possessing of these traits than another simply because of their assigned gender.
Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, I think it's an interesting problem specifically within psychedelia, because psychedelics does seem to open a realm of the archetypes. And within the realm of our archetypes, our personal archetypes, it's like the archetypes are political too. And so just the fact that you're encountering a certain kind of sense of the sacred feminine doesn't mean that image doesn't have political situations or associations with it, or implications. That's the word I meant. And so there's sort of a sense of like, wow, you know, it's in the visionary space, it's in this dream world, it's in fairy tales, it's in, you know, ancient myths. Great, that's fine. But it doesn't mean that there aren't these sort of implications that we have to have the kind of critical dimension to it as well. And that's what I mean about the way in which the psychedelics have a critical potential that is often underplayed in the light of the desire for enchantment, for transcendence, for beauty, for intimacy, for wonder, all great things. But if we don't also have criticality in there, which means being aware of our own projections, which means being aware of our social location, which means being aware of having to have responsibility for how we speak about and interact with these things in light of their power. If we don't have that, then we're just going to stay in a certain kind of loop, and it becomes more like, you know, whatever, new age party culture or something like that. And I feel like these things are happening. I mean, that's why we're having this conversation. But it definitely can happen more.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. One of the things that also, even in my own history, like, I feel like I've gone to like super extremes on my like psychedelic journey, where at one point I was kind of in the more of this belief of like gender being very determining of my traits, and feeling like this almost sense of like sacredness around gender and my gender roles, and feeling like how I was like born female as opposed to being socialized female. And then went to the other extreme where I was like, this is all bullshit. Like, none of these traits are like at me because of like the sex hormones that are in my, you know, in my body. But now I've kind of come more to this middle way of like, all right, there is something to be said about like gender and gender expression that is obviously very real. I identify as being a very feminine woman. I like to wear dresses. I like to have my hair done. I like to have my nails done. And that's something that I have a lot of like fun doing. It's something that I enjoy.
But I also don't want, one of the things I worry about is I feel like people see that and, you know, the associations with, oh, here is this very feminine presenting person, therefore she must be submissive, therefore she must be, she must be a really quiet person, she must not be like very smart and intelligent. And for me, like, one of the things that I do is I feel like I have a very good balance in myself of the feminine and masculine, and also like the androgynous non-gender. But by being able to be like a very femme presenting individual, but then also at the same time too, like, being a very strong, independent woman who is trying to go out and create changes in the world.
Yeah, that's you know, good on you. But I think it's important to emphasize that while you can get to the place you describe without psychedelics, I think that the way in using them consciously and critically, as well as exuberantly and spiritually, can help bring you to that place, and precisely that middle ground between the mm-hmm. way in which we are bodies. We are mm-hmm. bodies with natural histories, with their own agendas, with their own patterns, with their own forces, whether or not we think about that in terms of gender or mood or the cycles of the moon or whatever you want to say. It's like we are physical bodies, and those bodies take chemicals, and the metabolism of those chemicals produces effects. It's a deeply biological process. On the one hand. And on the other hand, you're introduced into this world of images, of stories, of myths, of cultures, of histories, all of this strange kind of much more virtual sort of reality where things are veiled and shifting and shimmering, and that openness, that possibility of telling new stories, of engaging different stories, of mixing up stories, all of that is also sort of part of the mix. So I see psychedelics ideally as a place where we reconcile and indeed, intensify even the way in which our cultural programming on the one hand interacts with the biological world that we are always already embedded in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think also on the other hand, one of my concerns about psychedelics as well is that I've also seen the opposite happen, where people become stronger in their beliefs of the ideas that have been kind of handled to them through patriarchy, such as like having those ideas of gender and gender roles like strongly reinforced. Like the man is supposed to have more control in the relationship, like almost like that, the way I see religion kind of playing out in Christianity, where the man is considered to be, you know, the stronger one in the relationship. Which that's really interesting to me, that I also see psychedelics kind of doing the opposite of that. But I mean, it also kind of reminds me that there was a period of time when psychedelics are still legal, where they were trying to use psychedelics to they gave them to individuals who identified as gay, and they tried to turn them straight with psychedelics. And it's like,
well, we're going to have to end it right there.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to have to end it there, Katie. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, until next week, we'll be talking about the Yazidi. Keep your minds open.